Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, hi, folks. That's my new introduction. I hope you like it. Sounds a bit formal to me. But, you know, that's another side of me. My radio show's a bit informal than a lot of other things I do. Speaking of more formal, I have a new scientific article that just came out in a journal called Medical Hypotheses. And the article is about the origins of guilt, shame, and anxiety in biological evolution. What I've done is taken the basic theory in my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, and focused it on a scientific analysis that's a little more, you know, a little more like a journal article, because I wanted to get this theory past peer review and out into the medical literature, and I was really glad to do that. And you might find it interesting to see how I'm trying to pull together science to show that guilt, shame, and anxiety are actually biological instincts, nearly the same strength as hunger and sex, and probably, unfortunately, about the same strength as love, which accounts for why we have more guilt, shame, and anxiety than love in the world. Take a look at it. You can find it on my website, breggin.com, by going to selected scientific papers, and it'll be number one. I'm hoping that within the next few hours, we'll also have a more easy to get to link right on the top of the website, right to the article. But it's not hard to go to selected scientific papers, and it should be right at the top. I hope you find it interesting. I think these ideas are important to be discussed, and we'll be doing some of that today. Mel, are you online? Do we have my next guest here? Mel?
Yes, I'm here, Peter. I'm with you.
Oh, good. I had a little lag, and I thought, uh-oh, because I didn't there it is. I didn't get a good chance to look at what I'm doing today because I had some Skype problems before I got started. Folks, let me tell you about Mel. You may have heard him on an earlier show. This is a good man who's doing good work and has just very creative approaches to psychotherapy. He is a therapist. He's a marriage counselor. He does writing and he does speaking. He says of himself that he consistently advances, constructs, and explores approaches for personal life mastery that transcend the limitations of traditional therapy practices. He is evolving he's pioneered and evolving an approach called emergent thinking. We're going to talk all about this today. And he has an interest in integrating quantum physics with self-actualization, something, by the way, I wrote a paper about at Harvard in 1955 as an undergraduate, and since then not pursued, which is interesting. And we talk about maybe why I didn't pursue that. But it was just a paper for class. He's embracing the uncertainty and the potential to activate defining moments, and I'm sure he relates that to quantum physics. He practices in Westport, Connecticut. He's the author of The Art of Intimacy, The Pleasure and the Passion, and his forthcoming book, A Shift of Mind from Being to Becoming. By the way, he comes very much out of a tradition that I was very much heavily steeped in. One can tell that when you talk about being and becoming. We might talk about some of the great humanistic psychologists and even theologians from whom we learned. One of the most interesting things about him to me is that he's published more than 100 articles in Psychology Today. I think that's quite an achievement. And he's got his own blog at melschwartz.com. Last night I sent Mel my article on guilt, shame, and anxiety out of medical hypotheses, and I think it stirred up all kinds of understanding, misunderstandings, and things to talk about. But before that, I'm just going to unleash Mel to talk about anything he wants to. Welcome again to the show, sir.
Well, thank you, Peter, and thank you for having me back. I really enjoyed our last conversation, and stirring things up is a great way to go after it. I have a question for you, Peter. When you were speaking about guilt, shame, and your article's fascinating, I got to it about 11:30 last night, and it's going to take a few more reads for me to really digest it. But question, do you see love as a biological function, or do you see love perhaps also as a spiritual?
Well, I think component? It all begins with what gets built into our biology, and certainly our spirituality is also built into our biology. I think I'm very much with Bowlby on this concept, which is that human beings basically grow and thrive on attachment. From the time we are born, our brains are very undeveloped. Our brains are going to double in size in about a year or so. During that time, we're going to be becoming who we are as a result of the nurturing or lack thereof that's given to us early on. And by 4 or 5, we probably are who we are in a lot of ways. So I think that we are the quintessential mammals in being attached to each other, nursed by our mother or some other woman, certainly for millions of years as we were developing toward Homo sapiens. We were being nursed by our mothers and supported by a small family. So I think all of this is built into us biologically, and that opens up all of the capacity for love, which I think is a part of that built-in capacity. And in fact, I think love, as difficult it is to define, is a requirement for developing some sort of sanity at a very, very early age. So, yeah, love is biological, and violence is biologically built in, and both are stimulated by the environment, but that's the same with all instincts. And what's unique in my theory, which no one has ever quite put together, is that guilt, shame, and anxiety in one of their basic functions is a kind of anger management, so that despite our violence, we can live together in these intimate relationships. And all of that's expanded in the book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. I will now be silent for a while. Go ahead, Mel.
A couple of thoughts that arise for me, and I appreciate, you know, how you're looking at guilt and shame as adaptive complexes. When you say love is built into the biology, there's a term, a word, it's reification, R-E-I-F-I-C-A-T-I-O-N. The great philosopher Alfred North Whitehead referred to it similarly as the theory of misplaced concreteness. I'll give you an example. Reification is when our minds make up a word or a term, and then we come to think of that word or term as having an independent existence, being real. And we forget that our minds made it up. So, for example, I may hear a therapist saying, you know, my patient Jane has ADHD. And I'll say, what do you mean she has ADHD? You can't have it. It isn't a real thing. And they'll look at me upset. And they'll say, what do you mean? I say, ADHD are 4 words that a team of psychiatrists put together to describe behavior that we think we can agree upon. It's a description of something. It isn't a thing. It's a descriptor. So So similarly, when we use the word biology, for me, Peter, biology is a category that we have constructed, our minds have constructed it, to organize information, to add to complexity in our knowledge base. But I have a differing way of looking at things. See, based upon my worldview and my spiritual beliefs, I'd say to you, well, Peter, what if I believe that I, as a soul, am eternal, and I exist sometimes in physical form in my body, which has a biology, and sometimes I exist not in my body. Perhaps I believe in reincarnation, or simply traditional heaven, and that love for me is a universal that is in no way limited to my biology, but yes, we can find it in my biology. Similarly with the brain. You know, I spoke 2 weeks ago at Yale for the Society of Consciousness Studies, great organization, and many of the people in this organization in their brain studies are putting forth the position that consciousness isn't produced by the brain. We can find it there, and it's located there. But consciousness may exist in what's called a universal mind, which also explains telepathy and synchronicity. And so to explain this, I would put it this way. If I'm walking on the beach, and I look behind me, and I see my footprints in the sand behind me, the sand didn't produce my footprint. My footprint left its mark there. You know, near-death experience arguably is another reason why we might look at brain activity as not producing consciousness, but it resides there. But that aside, coming back to your thesis, I don't disagree with what you're saying, but my way of looking at it is different in that I don't reduce it only to the biology. That's an aspect of it.
What in the world ever made you think I only reduce it to the biology?
Well, when you were talking about love, and I just asked that question of, is love as fundamental as violence? And, you know, you're saying to me, well, you can see love in the biology, but do we see it elsewhere?
Well, I have no doubt at all about that, but I think the contribution that I'm making is to say that just as we have been able to study animal behavior to see what is given to an animal,
yes,
in terms of its capacities. For example, one of the more interesting things I'm studying right now and thinking about, and many other people have done, is the capacity of our dogs to love us. What does that mean? Where does that come from? How much, yes, of it developed between us and the dogs? How much of it is evolutionary? But we can look at the human being in terms of an evolving creature that has been evolving now for millions and millions of years, has been walking on 2 feet for several million, and has developed certain characteristic ways of relating which are inherent to every single human being, regardless of their spiritual outlook. And one of those is the nurturing process of infancy, which is common to many, many kinds of animals and birds, and
yes,
which more and more takes on the qualities we associate with love. As you look closely at even at birds, for example, let alone at mammals, and that this is a really, really important thing to understand. Why does everybody have guilt, shame, and anxiety, pretty much? Well, I think because it was built in order to, by natural selection, that literally we were, those of us that felt guilt, shame, and anxiety had an advantage over others because we would inhibit our violence in the intimacy of the family. Now, on top of that takes place social evolution, and Darwin pointed out that you can't explain the highest understandings of love, such as the golden rule in his mind, by biology. It has to evolve some kind of higher processes that are way beyond that, that have to do with reason and ethics and thoughtfulness, and I think he might have even said spirituality. nonetheless, the contribution I'm trying to make in that particular paper is the foundation. And I think it's up to each of us to learn to overcome guilt and anxiety or transcend it. And the same with violence. But love, I think it's built into us. I think our dogs feel it. I think that chimpanzees feel it for each other, and especially mothers when they're raising their kids. And we have to acknowledge that to understand ourselves, even as we start to develop our own spiritual approaches.
You know, when you just referred to the golden rule, my belief currently about the golden rule is that when we exist and live our lives under the illusion of separation, what I mean by that is, you know, we still, for the most part, operate under the worldview that was given to us by Newton and Descartes in the 17th century, which pictured the universe in reality as a giant machine, which left us as separate cogs in that machine. And I believe this induces us to isolate, compete, root ourselves in individualism, which doesn't permit us or enable us to come into the capacity, into the fuller capacity for love. Yet, quantum physics revealed in the last century that the universe appears on the quantum level to be essentially inseparable. Now, since that time, in the last number of decades, increasingly we're finding that the same seems to apply on our macro level of inseparability. For me, and in my work, inseparability truly opens the door to the golden rule. If myself and the other are indeed essentially inseparable, then my generosity, affection, love, compassion, empathy for the other is going to ultimately reward myself. You see, there's a self-interest in my generosity of spirit and heart because there's no division between myself and other. And I believe that that worldview, that emerging worldview, may typically do a lot to alleviate violence. Think of it this way. My right arm, let's pretend my arms and my hands have separate consciousness. My right arm looks at my left arm and sees it as separate, doesn't realize it's connected to the same body. And because it's different, it has violent or warlike tendencies, which happens often. They don't realize they're part of the same body. In inseparability, we realize that we're all part of the same oneness and the same wholeness. I believe that that will serve a lot to mitigate violence and aggressiveness.
Well, you don't basically have much difference from me or Martin Buber or Gandhi or Christ in many, many ways.
You put yourself in some pretty good company there, Peter.
I said you don't.
Oh, thank you. And then you put me in too high a company.
But those are my heroes among them. And I do think that all that is true, but I don't think we should get too utopian about it, because the struggle that we all still have is with our biological heritage. That's why I call the guilt, shame, and anxiety negative legacy emotions. We do have to – we can't leap beyond, I think, in some ways, knowing who we are on the more gross level while we proceed to understand ourselves on the more loving level. So we may have just a somewhat different emphasis.
Yes.
Our spirituality, I mean, everyone's spirituality is unique. I certainly govern my life, and so does my wife Ginger, on spiritual values. I wouldn't be doing all the reform work I've been doing since I was a child if I didn't feel motivated by some connectivity to all of humanity. I'm not sure why you're opposing it to what I say. I think a lot of what you're saying has in fact has been in these in the air of philosophy for a long, long time. Is there some part of it? I think it's well said. I think it's good. Is there some part of it you're feeling is really unique or really in opposition to what I'm saying?
I think that we're probably looking at two differing aspects, and each of us are emphasizing different aspects.
Well, I think that's actually what's going on. I could just as well write a book without any biology in it if I just wanted to talk about my spiritual life. But I do think it's very important to have an empirical, scientific understanding of biological evolution and how it's brought us to the place we are. And I think the place we are that it's brought us to is that we thrive on loving relationship. And this is where you and I think, have a good starting point. Human beings thrive on loving relationship. And incidentally, so do puppies and so do chimpanzees' babies. We thrive on loving relationship. I don't know. It's that you're, I wasn't quite sure why you wanted to call it a reification. But I think we thrive on loving relationship. And from that, we have to build all useful, at least all good philosophies and spirituality.
So let me ask you this. Agreed, we thrive on loving relationship. Then what do you believe gets in the way of our moving toward where we thrive?
I think that that's where guilt, shame, and anxiety and violence come in. We have a huge inheritance of being violent and a huge inheritance of guilt, shame, and anxiety, which in your terms, and I think they're good terms, and I kind of think that way too, guilt, shame, and anxiety make us separate from each other. Whenever we feel guilt, shame, and anxiety, we are whacked out and separate and isolated and feeling terrible and not appreciating ourselves and not able to love. So that in addition to having the positive values we're talking about, I emphasize also the identification and letting go of guilt, shame, and anxiety. That I do much more in my book than in my article. In my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety.
When will your book be out, Peter?
It's been out. It's been doing quite well. It's had a few printings already. It's been out since December.
I look forward to reading it. So, you see, it's just a question for us of what we're putting first. I would propose that living under the container of separation is what, in fact, evokes guilt, shame, and anxiety. And I appreciate that you just put it the other way. Guilt, shame, and anxiety induce us to feel separate.
So I think it's circular.
What if they're both true?
I think they're both true. We have the built-in propensity for this. That's why it's elicited in every culture. Everybody agrees that shame and anxiety are in every culture. And then there's quibbling about when does guilt appear. And I think it might be something that comes a little later. I'm not certain. But it's in every culture, every society, every person, every childhood. So it needs to be taken as a common denominator to be understood, I think. And I think that's very, very important. But I agree with you that the goal is to live a more loving life and to not experience separateness from the universe. I myself love to live on water because for whatever reason, I think it's rooted in my childhood, when I stand in front of water, I'm much more able to think of myself as a part of God, of love, of nature, of all human beings and so on.
I feel similarly, and I live on the water as well. And also, water evokes movement and fluidity. It's the opposite.
You live on a river.
Static.
You must live on a river.
No, on Long Island Sound.
Oh, okay. Yeah. My lake doesn't have so much fluidity. It's more like a deep pool of spirituality. Cayuga Lake, 450 feet deep.
Peter, on a more practical level, a lot of my work is devoted to communication. When I work with couples, and see what had once been a loving union, which is unraveling, I see ineffective communication very often at the heart of that. And the communication takes the form of separation, which prohibits empathy and compassion, which are the two energies that were so prevalent at the start of a loving relationship.
Well, why have they gotten separated?
Well, look, I think part of the separation is due to ineffective communication. And this is primarily due to the fact that we are uneducated in communication. Did you ever right.
See, here, Mel, is where I'd say you're too much on the surface. Because from my own view, when I watch the evolution of a relationship and why it deteriorates, it's because as people become intimate, they get slammed with their guilt, shame, and anxiety reactions, and they take it out on each other. They don't understand what's happening. Their violence increases. So to me, to say it's lack of communication, communication about what?
Well,
I think that people don't often understand what's driving them.
If I'm aware, if I am cognizant of the fact that I am feeling guilt, if I can see my reaction and not become my reaction, then I'm in a position to communicate it. I can say
that's what I would say. See, I again think we come at it with a little different emphasis. I would have emphasized communication more maybe in the past. I think that what's missing is loving communication. People have lost track of loving communication because they've gotten slammed with guilt, shame, and anxiety. And then they either go numb or they go angry.
Well, suppose I were to say to my wife, you know, I was feeling overwhelmed with guilt a few moments ago. Let me tell you what I was experiencing and what prompted it for me. That could start an emotionally intimate conversation.
Sure.
All right. But we're not oriented to communicate that way because we don't notice our reactivity. We don't notice our guilt or shame. We become it, and then we communicate in defense of it, and we act angrily toward one another. That's why emotional intimacy tends to dissolve in a relationship. And it's very sad, but I would argue, and I'm speaking now from my professional experience, that when I work with individuals and couples and I teach them to communicate effectively, whereby it's not adversarial, you're not communicating in terms of making a point or winning a point. There's no right or wrong. Because if I have to win a point, that means the other person has to lose. We know where that's going to go, don't we? So the goal is for me not to feel frustrated, I need to communicate in a way in which the other can hear and take in what I have to say. That is a learned and acquired skill, but nobody ever taught us how to do this.
So yeah, I don't think anybody who does therapy would disagree with that. I think we're talking more about some of the underlying emphases, but I don't think anybody who does therapy would disagree that people have to learn to communicate. I would say love to communicate from unconditional love, to be a source of love. It's another concept that I like that's in all my work. We need to be a source of love, and we need to communicate it, and we need to let go of the things that get in the way. And I think, it's in that nexus that all therapists agree.
We've just done a role reversal because you just went utopian on me, and I was becoming practical.
Yes. Well, I think we all agree on some of the practical stuff. I think we do.
We may agree on it, on the need for it, but it's really much more of an art form and much more nuanced, and it is learnable. But who's doing the teaching? I mean, one arguably shouldn't have to be in therapy. This should be taught in school. It should be part of our curriculum. Emotional intelligence and effective communication, if taught in school, I argue, would lead toward perhaps a significantly different experience of life and of relationships.
Well, I think it might be, but that's where you and I would probably politically differ, which is that as soon as we open up the way to to more and more teaching of psychology in school, eventually what we'll get is a totalitarian,
well, Peter,
authoritarian psychology at our schools. So it's a large political problem of when you want to teach some of this, because it doesn't come out the way us nice guys want it to be when the government takes over.
I'm not referring to this as teaching psychology. What
well, I mean, when teaching emotional intelligence in school, for example.
What is more fundamental to our happiness?
No, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that
being able to communicate effectively.
No, we're not disagreeing at all about that. I'm just saying that I think that human beings are going to always be so flawed that when the government begins to implement something like emotional education or probably even sex education in the schools. Sex education would provide us a good example. That it's a serious problem because the government is not the benevolent parent that we wish it were.
I agree it isn't, yet nevertheless sex education is taught.
Yes, I'm not so sure it's useful and good. But let's not get into the political. We could talk about that a lot. You and I have a lot of agreement in some areas. Well, but maybe the political is important. I think there is an element of utopianism in the way you're thinking.
But it's a beautiful utopianism.
It's beautiful.
Let's pause for a moment. For me, shared meaning around a word is important to have a congruent communication. What do you mean by the word utopian?
I think if you ignore human nature,
mm-hmm,
and don't build your theories the way our founding fathers and mothers did or tried to, if you don't build your theories about recognition of the flawed nature of human beings, which is, I do not believe, going to be mass curable, if you don't take that into account when you're building your politics, your education, you'll be in trouble. We have to go to break. I've been run over 2 minutes here. Let's go to break and come back, and you can begin with a rebuttal to that very brief statement.
Okay.
It's not liberal, it's not conservative, it's progressive, the truth that empowers, right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
The Progressive Radio News Hour is an antidote to government and corporate propaganda. Distinguished guests are featured, some are world figures, all are independent thinkers. Truth and full disclosure are featured. Vital domestic and world issues mattering most are discussed. Today is the most perilous time in world history. Ukraine's crisis escalated things dangerously. It's the gravest one since World War II. A potential clash of civilizations looms. More than ever, vital information is needed. It's our most precious commodity. How we use it matters most. Peace and security depend on it. The Progressive Radio News Hour, 3 times weekly, live on Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, plus 2 pre-recorded archive programs. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
Gary Null's incisive documentary and informational films on today's most crucial issues have won dozens of international awards. As a free service to listeners, acclaimed films such as War on Health and Seeds of Death are available to watch in their entirety online. Just go to YouTube and search for Gary Null. Thank you for your continued support.
Carrie Harrison with you, inviting you to join me on The Smart Show every Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're not able to catch me live, you can go to the archives at prn.fm or harrison.fm. Don't forget, it's impeccable behavior to rate the show on iTunes. We come to you each Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time, live from Hollywood, where we bring on the movers and shakers, whistleblowers and muckrakers. There's nothing like it anywhere else, and it's here on PRN.FM. If you like a smart show, then join me, Carrie Harrison. It's Harrison on the Progressive Radio Network. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
PRN. Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Peter Bregan. I've gotten so involved with my conversation with Mel Schwartz that I haven't told you that it's Mel Schwartz for 30 minutes now. Mel's a psychotherapist. He's in Westport, Connecticut. I'm sure you can locate him that way. He's an author, and his forthcoming book is A Shift of Mind, From Being to Becoming. And he writes on Psychology Today and also at MelSchwartz.com. We are being very, very philosophic today, and I hope it's as interesting to you as it is to me. Don't usually have the opportunity in my personal life to talk on this level. So, Mel, welcome back. We got about 25 minutes left. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. So we left off with the word utopian.
Yes, we did.
During the break, I had a few thoughts, which were, not too many centuries ago, the idea that every child should be free from labor and work and should have an education might have appeared utopian at that time. So in other words, things change. And what appears utopian now, given our evolutionary process, may the future date no longer appear utopian. I was giving a talk once, I was conducting a seminar on relationships, and a gentleman in the audience was taking offense at something I was proposing, and he stood up and he said to me, "You know, Mel, you sound like an idealist." And I paused, and I smiled, and I said, "Why, thank you. The world needs some of us, doesn't it?" So I don't take offense at the term utopian. I appreciate, Peter, for you, that it sounds like if it suggests it's not grounded in reality. All I'm doing to make it a little more relative, the concept, is that current reality changes. And in our evolutionary process, it may be as humans, notwithstanding how long we've been around, we may still be in our infancy. And so I don't constrain or limit what the future may look like because of what it has been to date.
Well, you don't really have any disagreement with me on that. In fact, as much impact as I've had, my great hope is that 200 years from now, more people will be reading my books than they are now.
Yes.
Because I think that they have essential truths in them, including about the science of not just the essential truths that we all kind of look at about love and connectedness, but the hard science, I think, that I'm writing about is not going to be fully recognized for a long, long time. But still think there's a difference between us in the groundedness issue. I'm not even sure. And maybe you would agree with this. Progress is by no means guaranteed. We could, 1,000 years from now, be much worse off than we are today. We could be snuffed out by then at the rate we're going. So I'm not sure about the progress issue, but you may not be either. And I think that what I do because I believe I'm supposed to do it. I'm supposed to behave in a certain way and do certain things and reach towards certain goals. But one of those goals to me is not just looking at love and connectedness and things like that, which which Mal, probably like you, I've been thinking about since early teens, or maybe earlier, but also to look at just what a base human nature we inherit and what are we going to do about that? How are we going to work with that knowledge and not lose sight of it, because I think that we have to be really, really aware of that, because even today it's entirely possible that violence on the level of, say, the Nazis or the Stalinists could once again take over a good portion of the world, a huge portion of the world. So I just, you know, I have a little bit different emphasis maybe, but we're very similar in our hopes and ideals. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that violence, besides instinctive urges, which I appreciate your points about them, but you see, I see violence as violence is occurring from an antagonism, a perception of differences between you and myself. I read somewhere that shared inquiry, dialogue, is nonviolent. When you have two people or two countries or two groups inquiring together, nobody trying to assert right versus wrong, the truth. When you break away from objectivity and you experience a shared inquiry is nonviolent. I'm not talking about violence simply on physical levels here. I'm talking about the violence that occurs on emotional levels when you see two people in a heated debate trying to prove each other right or wrong. When we can shift our perspective about how to engage each other into a non-competitive, non-adversarial position, so things are collaborative, and there's a shared inquiry, there's new learning. It's generative. It isn't violent.
But Mal, everybody agrees on that. I think everybody who's thought about it agrees on that. Yet we do not have that occurring except once in a while in good marriages, once in a while in friendships, hardly ever in a group of any kind whatsoever is that the dominant ethos. And I think we have to face that reality while we are looking ahead to increasing a world of mutual understanding, love. And I deeply believe in those things. The whole last third of guilt, shame, and anxiety is about that idea. But at the other hand, we also need to look realistically at just how, we need to look at a bigger picture of how difficult that has always been to implement and what we're going to do to implement it, because as an idea, it doesn't operate very well among human beings, although it's the best idea there is.
If I spent my life walking around with dark sunglasses on, I would be seeing things differently than you would. And my point that I'm making here, which you may be wondering, where am I going with this? The way we think, and I don't mean just presently, but historically, the way we think, not what we think, but the way we think, has been our filter. It's been our dark sunglasses, which I think has contributed mightily to the violence and the aggression that we've experienced. And the difference in your thinking and my thinking at this point is due to, I'm inferring from what you're saying, that because of what has always been, you're concluding that's how it is and we need to come to terms with that. Whereas I'm looking at what has always been and saying, what if we learned to think differently? What if we changed our filter? What if we actually began to appreciate the oneness, the kindred quality, and emphasize, look at the culture we live in here, Peter. Are empathy and compassion valued culturally and societally here in our culture, or is individualism and winning? Let's look at the word awful. At one point in time, the word awful was a good word. It meant something full of awe. So I wonder, how did awful become a bad word? How did it become a pejorative? And I only can conclude, and I have no way to prove this, is that something that's full of awe is actually now non-rational, non-logical. And so we've cast it aside. Look at the word wonderful. At some point, wonderful meant something full of wonder. But we don't honor or value wonder any longer. So now your child comes home with an A and you say, that was wonderful. We don't mean it was full of wonder. We mean job well done. So the way we think and the way we live as a culture induces more and more competition and separation, which I would argue leads to more aggression. Now, yes, historically, when there was a scarcity of food and goods and services, and one had to literally fight and be violent to survive, there was a biological need for it, agreed. But in certain parts of the world today, you don't have to be violent, but that tendency to exist, I think, is not only instinctive, as you're pointing out, but it's further induced by the fact that we're playing from the wrong game plan. Our thinking is distorted. And when we learn to alleviate that distortion and come into an inner ecology of thinking, which has a coherence, it becomes a lot less violent.
Well, I have no doubt about, in some way, you know, about the goal that we want to be more and more loving. But it does have practical applications. For example, I don't look upon individualism at all as at all negative. I think that human beings need liberty to express themselves, to pursue their own lives, and if they wish, to compete. So we would probably come from a very different place in that regard. And one of the reasons why our founders put liberty first is they knew that no one could be trusted to be in charge of us. That human nature is so corruptible that even the kindest talking leader was a menace.
Yes.
And that there's no immediate way around that. So what they said, given what human nature is, and they really looked at human nature, given what human nature is, we can't just talk about love, which they very much believed in love, community. Many of the founders had a very definite idea about that. Practical Ben Franklin saw life as a matter of people giving to each other and participating in a spiritual life, in a community life of some kind. But from the viewpoint that I bring to it, the starting point isn't necessarily lots of nice discussions about love, which I do have at times, trying to have one today, but a recognition that human nature being so flawed that some of the most, quote, loving philosophies have become the most horrendously violent, that we start with liberty instead. And we say that what we have to begin with is an understanding that no one should have the power to aggress against other human beings. That we have to start with that concept, the stopping of aggression.
If we could pause there for a moment. Agreed. No one should have the right to aggress against another. So recently, a province in Canada was trying to stop a multinational corporation from, I believe it was from fracking. The community decided, in their own well-being, that they thought it was dangerous to their environment, and they didn't want fracking. That community got sued by a multinational corporation that wanted to do the fracking, because under the new World Trade Organization, a multinational corporation has the right to sue and stop a locality from getting in the way of their doing business. So now we have a clash between excess competition, runaway competition, and the right to not transgress on the rights of the other. Things get complex.
I think that's fairly straightforward. I would believe in local communities having the liberty to protect themselves from what they see as aggression. And there is no doubt that multilateral corporations, I have actually risked my life confronting multilateral corporations in product liability suits. I know a ton about that. I think that whenever any group gets some sort of power and control, it becomes a menace to other human beings, whether it's a big government.
We're in agreement there.
Good.
But then runaway competition, unbridled competition, which still may look like liberty to some, runs
into... Well, that's a very complicated political issue. The problem, and I'm just not sure we should be going there, but we can go there a little bit, I guess.
Okay.
The problem you run into is who controls competition and how. And the more the government controls it, the more the government becomes the source of all violence and all control. The more the corporations control it, the more they become the source of all violence and all control. And ultimately, I think one of the most important things is to build a government which other people and corporations and interest groups don't have so much power to control. So that brings us to a small government theory, which is let's not have a center that other people seize that has all that power. But these are really complicated issues. But the important point for me about them for today's discussion is that if you don't recognize that human beings have such a tendency to be violent and controlling, that as soon as they get out of small groups where they can love each other within our limited capacities for the vast majority of people to love one another, you got to be educated, and I want to keep doing what you're doing. But in the world we're in, just talking about love, it's wonderful, but it is mostly, I think, going to work in your individual and personal lives. And that we have to look at the complexities of it all on this larger scale you're talking about, because human nature has these flaws. And we got to keep figuring out and working on how do we have organizations without their always turning on each other pretty much.
My consideration is what we call human nature may indeed only be human habit, and that the potentiality of human nature can shift and be actualized in a new and healthier direction, that we are not ordained to continue to live the way we have always lived.
Well, For the future millennia of thousands of years, I suspect we might even destroy each other, let alone get better. I think that the problem is, once you think human nature is malleable, which our founders did not, which is why they came up with the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, they did not think human nature was malleable. They thought there were inalienable rights, God-given, for individual liberty, so that each person could promote themselves. They figured that anytime somebody had really large ideas about changing human nature, that you'd have a catastrophe. And we have every time on a large scale. It's one thing for academicians to talk about this. What they tend to do then is exclude anybody like me who disagrees with them. That's their violence. They're not very loving, most of these academicians who talk this way. In fact, they're very rejecting of other viewpoints. But I think we really need to take into consideration human nature here and not think we're going to drastically modify it, but rather keep looking at how do we discourage, contain violence, and how do we, work toward the things you want to work toward and that I do.
I would say rather than discouraging and containing violence, the goal would be to rethink violence. You see, the nature of our
minds... You can do that in a think tank, but meanwhile, the Middle East is once again about to explode, in part because a lot of people have put emphasis on communication, 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 rather than on deciding who's right, Peter, who's wrong, who are we going to defend.
Peter, the word means something different to the way they're using it than I do. You know, David Bohm described so aptly, and so did Gregory Bateson, our mind tricks us when it tells us the problem is out there, when in fact our mind, the way we think, has fully participated in creating the problem that's out there. It seems that this is a participatory universe instead of a discrete objective universe. So, of course, the Middle East is always about to explode because there hasn't fundamentally been new thinking. So old thought is going to create old reaction, old hostility, and old violence. What I'm prompting is a radically new way of thinking, of seeing things differently. So I appreciate you.
First of all, I don't think it's radical. I don't think it's radical at all. I think it's basically what Jesus was saying. It's basically what the best of Jewish thinking over the centuries has said. It's the best of what Darwin was saying. I don't think that what you're saying
is actually radical. When the victims of the when the relatives of the Charleston shooting victims went and in such a Christian way went to court and told the shooter that they forgave him, pure Christian behavior. That was exceptional. It was breathtaking. So when I say radical, I mean it the way I intended it.
Yeah, yes, and that's been with us a long, long time. I think what we're missing, in fact, more than ever, is recognitions of the limits of actual functioning human nature so that we can learn to both love and to protect ourselves, to love and to protect ourselves. And I think that a great deal of that is being lost because there is this utopian ideal which, if it occurs, may develop and evolve over millennia. But in fact, I think what we're still always going to be given is that we not only have to love, we have to know how to protect ourselves because human nature gets corrupted at the drop of a hat, including the people who talk the most about love. So it's a different view in that regard. It is a different view in that regard.
But
our goals, what we would like to see, is actually in some ways similar, in some ways not.
I would propose to you that for me, love requires vulnerability. If I am defended and defending against my vulnerability,
I mean defending against people who are going to harm you while being vulnerable where you can be.
And, so you don't believe that you can turn your enemy into your ally?
I don't think. I've worked a long time with Eli Lilly and Upjohn. I've worked a long time with the federal government and the FDA. So far, it seems to be going in the opposite direction.
Okay, but we've done pretty good with Japan and Germany.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow that.
I said, but we've done pretty good turning Japan and Germany into our allies.
Oh, yeah, until their self-interests change.
And that's
governments
that's
work on self-interest. For you to think there's a loving alliance between the United States and Germany, I think would be a disaster. I think there may be somewhat of a loving alliance between Great Britain and Canada, maybe, because we have some shared culture that's really very meaningful to us. But at any rate, I have a lot of experience with the real world, but so does every human being, anybody, a farmer or somebody who's waitressing in a restaurant. There's a real world, and it needs to be taken into account. My guest, Mel Schwartz, we are ending now. Mel, really interesting, and testing my intelligence, and I hope
I
that of
it
our
well,
listeners.
Peter. You be well.
Be well.